Morning. We have four cases scheduled for argument this morning, and we understand counsel in the first three have appeared and announced ready. So we'll call the first case on the 9 o'clock docket, Gary Earl Walker versus Southwest Basketball LLC et al. Spence.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Joe Spence. I'm here today representing the appellant, Mr. Gary Walker. I think the issues that are presented to the court all center around one question, and that is, did the trial court err in concluding that no agreement was formed between the parties? We think the answer to that question is yes, because we believe the evidence conclusively established the contract between the parties, including all elements of the plaintiff, Mr. Walker's breach of contract cause of action. I know the court is aware of the facts, but there are a few pertinent facts I would like to go through that I think lead to the principal issue I'll be arguing. First of all, the appellees, who are they? One of the appellees is Southwest Basketball. This is a company that owns approximately four National Basketball Development League teams in the Southwest. One of those teams is the Fort Worth Flyers. They are owned and operated by the other appellee, which was NDBL, which is National Development Basketball League, Fort Worth. Southwest Basketball owns 80% of NDBL Fort Worth. Both of the appellees were operated and managed by a gentleman named David Kahn. He's relevant and pertinent to the facts in the case. My client, Gary Walker, made an initial investment of $150,000 in Southwest Basketball in two $75,000 increments. He made another $75,000 investment in NDBL Fort Worth. Those three investments are not the subject of this appeal. However, in August of 2006, my client got a call from Mr. Kahn. Mr. Kahn said, "We are not doing well. This is the downtime preseason. We've sold all the tickets we're going to sell prior to the season. This is the sort of the dead time of our operations. We need money." And he asked for $75,000. And so on August 30, 2006, this is Plaintiff's Exhibit 4, my client, Gary Walker, wired to Southwest Basketball $75,000. The fall passed, and in late fall, November, December, the operations still weren't good for Fort Worth Flyers. And that's when my client got another call. And Mr. Kahn said, "Look, we're trying to raise more capital. We're going to do it through what we call a Class D or D Series group of investors. And in order to raise that capital, we have to get a second amended operating agreement for Southwest Basketball, which will show these Class D investors." And Mr. Kahn told my client, "By the way, the Class D investors, their lawyer wants you, Gary Walker, to sign this second amended operating agreement." Well, my client said, "Well, you know, I'm not real happy the way things are going, and that $75,000 I gave you last August, I would like, if I'm going to sign this new agreement, I want my $75,000 from August of 06 back." And Mr. Kahn said, "Okay." And that's what led ultimately to a string of emails, and I have provided the bench with a highlighted copy of Plaintiff's Exhibit 5. And I did that for two reasons. Number one, it's, I think, the central document in the case. And number two, it is a string of emails that's read from the bottom up, and hence I put a green arrow on the side to indicate that this string should be read from the bottom up. I've also highlighted it. The emails from Mr. Kahn are in yellow. My client's email in response to Mr. Kahn's first email, which is on the bottom, is in pink. I also brought this to the court's attention because on page 8 of the appellee's brief, when they first introduced this email string to the court in their brief, they omit the first yellow section at the bottom, which I think is critical to the whole email. So here's what happened in this email. The very first one at the bottom in yellow, Mr. Kahn said, Gary, if you haven't already, please send in the signed signature page from the document distributed to Southwest Basketball Investors on 11:30. And the record indicates that that document, in the reporter's record, is the second amended operating agreement. It says, Laney Dillon, and that, by the way, the record shows, is Mr. Kahn's attorney. But that sentence before there, it says, we're aiming to close today. This was the second amended operating agreement and the D-Series investors. It says, Laney Dillon is collecting them, the signatures, and her fax number is this. So my client writes back, David, been unavailable. Please send in writing confirmation of our conversation, and I'll digress there. The record indicates, in reporter's record, that this email string confirming this agreement had been discussed previously orally, and this email string memorialized it. So he says, please send in writing confirmation of our conversation that Tim, that was another investor, and I will get our money back by end of month. Then I will find the email tomorrow and execute by end of day. So that's what my client sent back. And then the last email at the top in yellow says from Mr. Kahn, confirmed. Please send the signed signature page to Laney Dillon. We should be able to send checks to you and Tim within 48 hours of the close. And it's important to note that that 48-hour of the close is relevant to the very first email at the bottom, because Mr. Kahn was indicating, we want to close today. Now, I'll digress again for just a moment. That relates to their argument about this release and that this was a central issue in the case or a central element of the agreement. Our position on that is, first and foremost, it's not an essential term, and you can look to the email to note that there's no reference that the payment to my client is conditioned on any sort of release. There's nothing in the record that the parties ever discussed a release. And more importantly, the language of the email itself shows that he was going to cut these checks 20 or 48 hours within closing, and that they were going to close that day. There's nothing about that written word that indicates what they now come back after the fact and try to say, oh, that's not really what I meant. What I meant was, once we get those signature pages, we're going to have our lawyers draft up a repurchase agreement, an elaborate release, and that's going to take a month or two before we can ever cut you the checks. And again, I think it's important to note that under the law, that the meaning to be conveyed to this agreement and the terms of these emails is not the subjective intent of the parties or what they claim they were thinking at the time. It's what the parties said and did. And it's clear from this email that what the parties were saying is, my client was saying, you need my signature on that document. In consideration for that, I'll do it if you'll immediately return my $75,000. So that's essentially our position in this case, that this email string conclusively established as a matter of law the existence of an agreement, and frankly, the other elements are not really in dispute. They were conclusively established as well, that being breach. There's no question they never paid it. And so our position before the court below was, we conclusively proved the existence of this agreement and its breach, and we're entitled to our damages and attorney's fees. I will add one other thing about their release argument, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, well, release was an essential term, and because the parties didn't have a meeting of the minds on release, this email string can't be enforced. I've already argued to the court that there's nothing in the email that says that release is conditioned or a conditional part before my client gets paid. The email language itself clearly indicates that that wasn't contemplated in light of the quick 48-hour payment. But I think equally important, at page 94 and 95 and 103 of the reporter's record, Mr. Kahn admitted ultimately that the parties did in fact reach an agreement about the terms of the release. But what happened? It didn't get signed because Mr. Kahn changed the deal again. Mr. Kahn, once a release language was finally agreed to by the parties, Mr. Kahn said, oh, well, by the way, that check within 48 hours for the full $75,000, we don't want to do that anymore. We want you to sign a note, and we'll pay it out in three increments. Again, it's just an example of a party trying to retrade a deal after the fact and then trying to claim that somehow this email string can't be a meeting of the minds in an agreement because after the fact they wanted to retrade the deal or change certain terms. With regard to the issue of consideration in the brief of the appellees, one of the things I think they try to argue is, well, there may really not have been consideration for this. Of course, the consideration is found in the very first highlighted portion at the bottom of Plaintiff's 5, where he says, I need you to sign this second-minute operating agreement. And the record says and shows that, in fact, that's exactly what was required by the lawyers for the D-Series investors. Now, there's some claim that, well, it legally really wasn't required. But, again, that doesn't alter the fact that there was consideration because the D-Series investors' lawyer wanted it signed, and my client agreed to sign it in return for the $75,000 payment. There is a finding number 13 in the record which states that there has been no detriment to the appellant for signing the second amended operating agreement. But I would point the court to the Fort Worth ISD case at page 20 of our brief. And consideration can be not only a detriment to the promisee, but a benefit to the promisor. And, of course, when Mr. Kahn promised to pay back the $75,000, the benefit he received was my client's signature on the second amended operating agreement. So for these reasons, and I guess I'd be remiss to point out, we do have an alternative point regarding factual sufficiency that in any event, based on this string of emails and the testimony from the record, that the court's finding that there was no contract formed between the parties is against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. But that's an alternative point because it's our position that the evidence simply, in this case, conclusively established the agreement between the parties, and we were entitled to have that enforced as a matter of law. And that's what we would request this court do, to reverse the trial court and enter judgment in my client's favor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spence. Mr. Moses?
May it please the court, counsel. Appellant laid out the essential facts fairly accurately. This was an unbelievably simple case. It was tried in less than a day's time. There were three witnesses. There was the appellant, Gary Walker. There was the company's representative, David Kahn, and there was another investor, Tim Berry. Mr. Berry, through an entity he owned, made identical investments to the investments made by Mr. Walker. At its most fundamental, this court could resolve this case by simply looking at Exhibit 5, Plaintiff's Exhibit 5. If you were asked, as the court below was asked, to enforce this contract, it would be impossible. Why? Because Exhibit 5 isn't a contract. It lacks four of the essential requirements to constitute a contract. First of all, it outlays no offer. It presents when you have no offer, you can have no acceptance. There was absolutely no consideration. And finally, there was not a meeting of the minds. Now, appellant makes much of the fact that in the findings of facts and the conclusions of law, there's only a finding that there was no detriment suffered by plaintiff suffered no detriment in signing any sort of amended operating agreement, and that it doesn't go forward to state that Southwest Basketball received no benefit, but it does indirectly. Conclusion of law specifically says, number four, there was no consideration to support the plaintiff's breach of contract claims, and finding of fact number 14 adopts every conclusion of law as a finding of fact, as if it was set forth in full. When analyzing those findings of fact, they're given the same force and dignity as a jury answer. And what did the evidence actually outlay? It showed, as the first part of the email string in Plaintiff's 5, that there was a prior conversation, and that conversation was actually a three-way conversation. It included Mrs. Walker, N. Berry, and Mr. Kahn. And remember that Mr. Berry was actually aligned with Mr. Walker, and he testified as called by Mr. Walker, but his testimony supported Mr. Connor, the appellee's case. Specifically, what he said was, during this conversation, we realized that things were very grim for both Southwest Basketball and NBDL. The only chance of going forward was to obtain a new Series D investor. The most likely way of that Series D investor coming in was to have an amended operating agreement signed. But Mr. Berry said everyone understood that as a non-voting member, they had no right to have that series. They had no right to sign anything. It just was a convenience, an accommodation.
Who was it an accommodation for?
It was clearly, Your Honor, Justice Myers, it was an accommodation to Southwest Basketball or NBDL, but it wasn't anything that needed to be done. The Series D investor could have gone forward and probably would have gone forward, but as is usual, when you're making a business investment, you want to use a belt and suspenders approach.
If the attorney for the investor in your Series D, talking about $1.4 million being put in the new company, was insisting on the signature, then it doesn't really matter if there's an agreement somewhere that says you must sign, does it?
It doesn't, but the testimony, it says he asked. He requested that there be a signature. It doesn't matter, because even if he insisted upon it, it served as no consideration. I think that's the issue you're hitting of the four with that question, because there was nothing diluted. What appellant suggested was, well, you diluted my pie by having this new Series D investor come in. But during this phone conversation, they all conceded, we're not diluting the pie. We're creating a bigger pie. There may be more pieces, but our pieces actually at this point have a chance not to be stale, because we can move forward and hopefully salvage this thing.
Why is the consideration not that in exchange for my signature and satisfying the lawyer, it allows the deal to go forward? The implication being, he's insisting on it. If you don't do it, the deal's not going to go forward.
Because, Your Honor, there's no detriment. He's not losing anything, and Southwest Basketball's not receiving anything. All you're doing
They're
is
getting $1.4 million.
To reinvest in a condition. That $1.4 million was clearly a precondition to the next step. And he said so. Tim Berry testified as much. We get the $1.4 million, and then we'll get releases, and we will fully unwind the transaction. And the problem is, you can't, as a court of appeals, you don't have the benefit of hearing the testimony and seeing the evidence at first hand, and therefore you can't weigh the credibility. Tim Berry was an unbiased third party that if anything was aligned with Mr. Walker, and he testified specifically. We understood that in order to move forward, this was a condition precedent. We were going to hopefully get a new Series D investor involved. Once that Series D investor is involved, we were going to move forward with getting a settlement or resolution of our last investment. It's only the last investment that came into play, and we would unwind it. I think it's important to also recall that initially Mr. Walker refused to call that last investment an investment. He wanted to call it a loan because he didn't want to have to unwind it, because he too testified, I realized with an investment it would have to be unwound. We'd have to somehow undo the deal. And by looking at Exhibit 5, you can't undo the deal. It's no different than the Fort Worth case we cited, the City of Fort Worth versus Fort Worth ISD. That case is very close in analogy to this case. In that case, the City of Fort Worth and the Fort Worth ISD fought for years with Southwestern Bell, or Bell Telephone, on how do you value the phone lines that cut across the City of Fort Worth for tax purposes. And ultimately, the City of Fort Worth and Fort Worth ISD prevailed. Bell Telephone recognized, we've got a tremendous headache ahead of us on trying to figure out how to value this on an annual basis, so let's come up with a percentage of revenue basis. And they cut a deal, and they moved forward for years based on that deal. Ultimately, years later, they say, we don't want to move forward on this deal. We want to unwind it. City of Fort Worth says, okay. City of Fort Worth writes a letter, which could be replaced as Plaintiff's Exhibit 5 in this case, to the Fort Worth ISD. And that letter says, and I'm paraphrasing and I can quote because we have quoted some in the brief, that, I will quote, because if the city should negotiate a new agreement with Bell, we commit to the city to arriving at an appropriate agreement with the Fort Worth ISD. So the same thing as Exhibit 5. We come up with a new deal. We're going to unwind our deal with Bell. We'll go forward with the new deal with Fort Worth ISD. Fort Worth ISD sues. And the court found, just as this court should find, how could we enforce that contract? What are the terms of unwinding this transaction? What's the release supposed to look like? When is it supposed to be executed? There's not a meeting of the minds. This is nothing more than an agreement to agree, and that's unenforceable under Texas law. You have to look at Defendant's Exhibit 9 as part of the record, and there is no way anyone could have concluded that the parties agreed to a release language. To the contrary, the first email out of the box from Mr. Walker back to Southwest Basketball, NBDL, was an email saying, I've created a redline copy of Laney's document executed by me with attached redline changes to the second page, which constitutes a rejection of the release form. Mr. Berry, in turn, his first email back was, I've accepted your, and I'm paraphrasing, I've accepted that release, and his transaction gets unwound. There was something to enforce. There was an agreement, something more than an agreement to agree. They had the predicate act of getting the new Series D investor, and then they had the contract act of unwinding the transaction. Again, looking just at Exhibit 5, there's no way to enforce it. It's too vague and indefinite. All it says is we're going to agree in the future. This is the predicate act, and then we'll move forward.
Mr. Moses, how do you equate the language in the last portion of Exhibit 5? We should be able to send checks to you and Tim within 48 hours of the close.
And what,
that's very definite to me.
With what the parties testified to, and the court was the one who could judge that credibility, was once we closed the unwinding. This was a predicate. Tim Berry agreed he didn't get paid until 48 hours of his close of unwinding.
You're interpreting the word close to mean something different than the close of the $1.4 million Series D investment.
Not only did I interpret it as something differently, but the fact finder did, and that's the most important thing, Justice Meyer. The fact finder was there to weigh the credibility of all three witnesses, and two of the three understood it to be the same thing. As this court's aware, in today's society with email, people constantly send emails that this is one of the problems we have, and I've actually been before this court and recently where we had emails where people misinterpreted them differently. Because they're done just like this. It's like a string of thought, consciousness. And both two of the three people testified, we understood we were going to have to close the unwinding of the transaction. And in fact, Mr. Walker himself testified that he knew he would have to sign a release. He just didn't think that the release that was provided was appropriate because it was too complete. So all three of the witnesses testified that close meant we were going to unwind the transaction. You cannot undo an investment without unwinding it. If he was just paid $75,000, he would at that point still own his shares in these entities. That's not a permissible unwinding of the transaction. There's clearly no meeting of the minds. Two of the three people in the conversation understood it to mean exactly what the trial court found it to mean. One, after the fact, after first saying, no, this wasn't an investment at all, it was a loan, which the trial court could use to decide how credible the testimony was, said, no, ultimately, if it's a loan, we were going to unwind it and I was going to sign a release, but it wasn't the release you presented. The trial court was free to, as a fact finder, to say, I don't think there's a meeting of the minds. I don't think there was adequate consideration.
This email is really between a chief executive officer, person in charge of running the business of Southwestern Basketball, about an investment to come to Southwestern Basketball, and then about a payment to be made in consideration for a signature on a operating agreement, isn't it?
Well, it's Mr. Kahn in his capacity on behalf of NBDL, because that's where the Series D investment was made.
Well, in his first statement, we're talking about distributing money to Southwest Basketball investors.
Investors, but the testimony, again, the testimony was very clear that the Series D investor was going to be an NBDL, and that NBDL within that funded the four teams that you heard about. It's a top, NBDL, the four local teams, SWBB being the local Fort Worth team. And the test, even Mr. Walker agreed with this, that the money was going to go into NBDL. It would then could be funneled down, $75,000 of which could be used to unwind the SWBB transaction.
Thank you, sir.
The long and the short of it is, we've heard from appellant a jury argument or fact-finding argument, no different than closing at the trial court. The court heard the actual evidence, and in hearing the evidence, he found that, one, this was a transaction involving NBDL initially, and then that money would be funneled down through SWBB, and upon terms being met to unwind the transaction, the $75,000 last investment would be unwound. The court found Tim Berry did exactly that through his entity. It found that Mr. Walker refused to do that. Instead, as shown in Defendant's Exhibit 9, making a counteroffer or counterproposal, which served to reject the initial proposal. There was no meeting of the minds. The court found as much. You have to find absolutely no evidence in order to reverse the court. And there is evidence of a lack of the meeting of the mind. Two of the three people testified what they understood the contract ultimately to be. Exhibit 5, if you were asked to provide specific performance and enforce Exhibit 5, it lacks the definiteness, exactly as does that Fort Worth versus Fort Worth ISD case. In that case, they said, we commit to agree to get you paid your tax dollars, but they had no basis on which to pay those tax dollars. The Fort Worth court said, without a basis, there's nothing to enforce. It's too indefinite. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moses. Mr. Spence? Mr. Spence, you're claiming that this is a written contract, not an oral contract, correct?
I think that's ultimately true. There is evidence in the record that there was a conversation, oral conversation, that mirrored, if you will, what's memorialized in the email string, but that the email string, I believe, memorialized it. And so I to answer your question, yes, I think this is a written contract.
Okay. It seems to me that a key essential term is missing in this for it to be enforceable if it is a written contract, and that would be how much money we're talking about here. If this were just presented to me by itself, and I was looking at the four corners of the contract, I don't know that I'd be able to tell from the contract how much money Mr. Walker is talking about and how much money Mr. Kahn said that he would send within 48 hours of the close.
Mm-hmm. Well, my first answer to that question is, with regard to the record, that fact would be supplied based on the undisputed evidence, that the parties were free to explain the circumstances surrounding the agreement, which has always been the law, but that also there was evidence in the record of this oral discussion of which this memorialized. And so I would say, first and foremost, there's simply no dispute in the record that all of this email string related to Mr. Walker's August 30 investment. There was a draft of an agreement. In fact, Mr. Kahn thought after the August 30, 2006 wire of the $75,000, Mr. Kahn thought that there was an August 30 letter agreement that was signed by my client. It never was, but that document as well explain the $75,000. I'd also think there's case law that says when a written or oral agreement is documented by a series of documents, that those can be construed to constitute the entire agreement. So I guess that's really the answer I would have on that, is I don't think it's disputed whatsoever. In fact, it was conclusively established because both parties admitted that, and that term would be supplied, I think, by the undisputed evidence. With regard to rebuttal, I would very quickly like to say counsel's argument that that two of the witnesses testified that the 48 hours of the close language in the very last email somehow meant closing of the repurchase of the units and a release. I don't think anybody testified to that. I read the record yesterday, and I don't remember that whatsoever. Furthermore, it wouldn't make any sense to interpret that close any different than the closing reference he's talking about in the very first email. But all of that, to some extent, remains a red herring because it dovetails into the release argument they're making. And again, I'd like to reemphasize two points. When they came in after the fact with the release, here's what they tried to do. This is what caused the problem. They didn't send a release to my client that said, oh, with regard to this August 30th, last $75,000 in, we want you to release any claim you have to that because we're paying you back. They sent a release of claim to my client that said, we want you to release any claims you have to any investment you've made, including your original $150,000 investment. My client said, wait a minute, why would I do that? And then, as again, on page 95 of the record, Mr. Kahn finally admitted that he agreed to the release that my client wanted, but then my client couldn't sign the release because they changed the terms about the payout. So our position remains clear. This is not an agreement to agree. Those types of contracts generally say, with other documents to memorialize the agreement, to be executed later, et cetera, et cetera. And our position remains clear that there's simply nothing in this email string that would require a signature on a release as a condition to the payment. And therefore, we again ask this court to enforce the contract.
Were there any allegations of fraud?
I don't believe there were, Your Honor. I would have to go back and check, but I don't believe there were. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Spence, Mr. Moses. Appreciate both of you coming here this morning to present your arguments. The case is submitted, and you're all excused.